G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's a dangerous idea for you. You are an ape. I mean that in the kindest possible way. You are an ape. I am an ape. We Homo sapiens are apes. We are evolved creatures. We are mammals. So how much of what we do, how much of what we think, how much of the way we behave and act is caused by the evolutionary imperatives that we have inherited from tens of thousands of years as Homo sapiens, hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens, and millions, hundreds of millions of years as animals. Today's guest thinks quite a lot, and it's fascinating because what seems to be culturally constructed artifacts of our own civilization, whether that's differences between the sexes or our propensity for jealousy or war or tribalism or whatever it might be, may in fact lie deep inside our bones and our genes and our meat. Steve Stewart Williams is a professor of psychology. He's the author of the books Darwin, God, and the Meaning of Life, and more recently, The Ape That Understood the Universe. Please enjoy this chat with the one and only Steve Stewart Williams. I mean, you say that like some differences, like the differences between the sexes, are things that everybody knows except for social scientists.
Yeah.
Which is a funny way of putting it.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think the main thing is that there's a lot of resistance in academia, I think, to the idea that certain sex differences are products of anything other than nurture, environment, socialization. And I think the reason for that is that people worry, I think understandably worry, but I think ultimately misguidedly worry that accepting that there's a role for nature in shaping some average sex differences might set back the progress of the women's liberation movement of feminism.
And yet your claim is not that there are inferiorities.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So what do we know? Yeah, what do we know about where the nature nurture balance begins and ends?
Yeah, it's hard to put an exact line where it is. I do think though that there's good evidence for a strong role of nurture and a strong role of nature as well. And the evidence for a strong role of nurture includes, for instance, that the magnitude of different sex differences varies somewhat from culture to culture, nation to nation, and also from time to time. Different periods within the same culture over time, you get some variance. At the same time, though, there's a whole bunch of different lines of evidence that nature plays a role as well, and that it's not all just down to nurture. So the evidence, for instance, So some of the sex differences in aggression, for instance, various other things, they initially appear in a kind of nascent form really early on in the developmental process. A lot of them seem to appear across many different cultures. They seem to be they seem to appear often actually even when the culture tries to push against them. And the sex difference in aggression would be an example of that. In a lot of cultures, we try to clamp down on male aggression. And so we're actually trying to work against that sex difference. And nonetheless, you find the same sex difference seems to appear despite culture rather than because of culture. Another line of evidence, a lot of sex differences can be traced to some degree to prenatal hormonal exposure. Again, the aggression sex difference is a good example of that. Even within the sexes, prenatal hormonal exposure, testosterone exposure specifically, correlates with later propensity toward aggression. And then the final line of evidence, and I think probably the one that I find maybe the most persuasive, is the fact that in a lot of other species, non-human species, a lot of the sex differences that we see in our own species are found in other animals as well, animals that don't have culture to anywhere like a degree that we do.
And they I have heard it said that you know, to the people who say that everything is just that we are a tabula rasa and there's the, all of the differences between the sexes are culturally constructed. If you go to a dog breeder and you ask for a female dog and you get it home and you find that it's a male dog, you don't go, oh well, that's fine because you know, male and female characteristics are just culturally constructed. You go, hey, I wanted a female dog.
And they're not interchangeable.
I mean, you make the point that in physical differences, we don't find it so hard that if you line up every person in the world in order of height, we all understand that there's going to be a bias with women being on average shorter. You know, they're not, there are going to be women, there are going to be men who are shorter than some women and women who are taller than some men, but you're going to see a clear difference. But when it then comes to psychological characteristics, we feel uneasy about making those sorts of generalizations.
Yeah. And I think there's more scope to deny the role, to deny that there are the sex differences in the first place. Like, we can see in our everyday life with our own two eyes, we can see sex differences in height and other physical features. Whereas it's more abstract when it comes to psychological differences. So there's more scope to deny that it is there in the first place, but then there's also more scope to sort of realistically deny that there's any significant role of nature.
One of the simplest ways of sort of getting our heads around some of the psychological differences between the sexes is just the experience of childbirth. This is a sort of mammalian reality that you go back to quite a few times to sort of explain the different relationships that males versus females would have towards procreation and all of the other ripple effects that that implies. Can you sketch that for us?
Yeah. So that's the difference in parental investment between males and females. And in all mammals, the what's called the obligatory biological investment is higher for the females than for the males, because it's the females that get pregnant, that have to sustain the pregnancy, give birth, and it's the females that have to produce milk for the young. At least in natural circumstances, that's no longer you know, that's negotiable these days. But for most of human evolutionary history, we were the same as all other mammals, in that it was the females that had to provide, that had to nurse the young. And actually, on top of all that, there's also an average behavioral difference historically in terms of how much females versus males provide in terms of direct parental care. And what that means, the key thing there is that the maximum offspring number that females can produce is lower than the maximum number that males can produce. And that's the case in most mammals, but also actually right across the animal kingdom. It's a very common pattern that a minority of males can in principle have many, many more offspring than even the most reproductively prolific female could have. And my favorite way of introducing that idea to students and the like is to say, if you imagine that a man or any male mammal actually were to have, say, four mates in a single year, potentially at the end of that time, he could have four offspring. Whereas if a female were to have four mates within a year, then at the end of that time, she's going to have the same number of offspring as she would if she'd only had one. Obviously, other things come into it, into how many mates people might seek. But what that means is that throughout the course of our evolutionary history, there would have been a stronger pressure, selection pressure on males as opposed to females for a desire for multiple partners, a high sex drive and that kind of thing, just because that maximum offspring number is higher for males than females.
So I have friends who say that it's a bit of a myth that men are hornier than women, and actually women have a sublimated sense of sexuality, and once they're liberated from patriarchal ways of thinking, they're actually just as into sex with multiple partners as men are. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't think it's right, but I do think in some cases when people make that argument, I think they're actually reacting to maybe a slightly mistaken understanding of what the claim is, because the claim isn't that men have a really, really high sex drive and women don't. They're just not really interested in sex. Men are really, really interested in multiple partners. Women are not. It's a much smaller sex difference than that. It's a difference in degree rather than kind. So, And not only that, we're also talking about overlapping distributions. Just that the average is higher for males than females, but lots of variation in both sexes. It's exactly the same as the height sex difference, actually. Lots of variation within both sexes and lots of overlap between the two sexes. So I think in some cases, the claim gets people's backs up because they think it's making a more polarized claim. Men are like this and women are like that. I think that there is a lot of evidence that there is this average sex difference, though, and that it's not the case that women deep down are just like men, and that if they were just, if we could take off patriarchal barriers and the like, that men and women would be interchangeable in the sexuality department. Lots of evidence, including the fact that you find these same sex differences across every culture that we have good data for. There are no cultures, for instance, where you find that actually, rather than men being more interested in pornography than women, that actually women are the main consumers of pornography. No cultures where women pay men for sex much more often than the reverse. You just find the same pattern across culture after culture. You have a similar pattern in other species as well. Other species where the maximum offspring number is higher for males than females, same pattern. And it's not that females are not interested in sex. I think maybe a better way to capture it would be to say that they're choosier about their casual sexual partners in particular. So I've been saying so women aren't so different from men, but also let me rein in what I said about men. I don't want to give the impression that men are only interested in short-term sex and multiple partners. I think we're quite atypical, actually, as a species, in that we typically form long-term pair bonds, and whereas most male mammals are deadbeat dads and have nothing to do with the kids and don't know who the kids are, like, we're not like that. That's a rarity in our species. Most males in most cultures do invest in the kids as well. We have a strong paternal streak. So we're not just horn dogs or whatever.
What would be the evolutionary imperative for that? Why wouldn't we just be better off from the genes perspective going out and sowing our wild oats as much as possible?
I think that the main reason is that we have these big brains, and big brains had a number of consequences in terms of how much parental investment was needed for kids. So when our offspring are born, they're extremely dependent, much more so than is the case for many mammalian species. Very, very dependent for several years. And then they need input. They're not what biologists call nutritionally independent until 18 to 20 years of age, even in a traditional society. So they need tons and tons of investment. And whereas in most other apes, the females alone can provide all the investment that the kid needs, that's not the case in our species. So I think what's happened is, because our offspring are so expensive and require so much care, we've evolved various forms of what's called allomaternal care. So that's care from individuals other than the mother. That includes like grandparents and siblings and unrelated friends, but it also often includes males. And because our offspring needs so much investment, the fitness payoff of forming pair bonds, falling in love in effect with a kid and wanting to invest in the kid, the payoff of doing that was much greater for males in our species and somewhat reduced the extent to which males just wanted to sow their wild oats.
And so these sex differences, just spell out for us the mechanism of natural selection here so it's clearer. Let's hypothesize that there's a type of man who is slightly less enthusiastic about having multiple partners and a type of woman who is slightly more enthusiastic. What are the consequences for each of those candidates that nudge the population as a whole in one direction or another?
The consequence is that male who is slightly more toward seeking multiple mates potentially could have more offspring, and the male offspring would then inherit that tendency. So that tendency would slowly, go viral in the gene pool.
It would propagate through the population, right?
Yep, exactly. For the female, on the other hand, there'll be a stronger selection instead of for multiple mates, for choosiness about mates. Like, because the ceiling number of offspring that females could have is lower than that for the males, females' best bet for maximizing the number of surviving offspring that they have is to make better choices rather than seeking more mates, better mates.
And
mates.
Is the operative question there about the surviving offspring? Is that why I'm trying to get my head around, like, what's the downside for the woman in our, you know, pre-ancestry in the on the savannah for being really promiscuous as well. Yes, there's a lot of there's a lot of energy in having lots of babies, but is the suggestion that if she's having a baby every year, those babies are less likely to survive than if she only has one baby every 4 years?
It's a few things actually, but So I think in natural environment, it's quite difficult to have one baby a year, and three or one every 3 or 4 years is much more sustainable. But I'm not sure that feeds so much into the sex difference and interest in casual sex and multiple partners. So I think that's more about the fact that it just doesn't pay off as much as it does for males in such an obvious way. There are actually other ways in which it might do. There are certain ways, for instance, if a female has a partner who is infertile or the couple is kind of infertile together, that's one reason why seeking multiple mates might be good. Having multiple mates means that you might have several males. There are various reasons why it is possible that there would be some advantage for more than just one mate at a time. But this, the payoff is not so great, and therefore it's pulled away further. The distribution has been pushed up further for males than for females.
Right, I see. Yes, because if you are a woman who has a propensity to have lots of sex, then the best that you're going to be able to do is that one baby a year or whatever it might be, and those are going to be poorly cared for children because it's going to be chaos in your life. You're exactly. likely to die during childbirth and all those other things that men don't have to endure.
Exactly. And women tend not to have to anymore, but just through most of human evolutionary history they did, and the idea is that that is when these tendencies were forged.
Well, you just pointed to one common criticism of evolutionary biology, which is, yes, this all may have been relevant back on the savannah, but, you know, the reason why I am aroused by pornography today is a totally different context. There are all kinds of cultural cues. There's all kinds of free will that comes into play. I'm not just being driven by banal, mundane evolutionary forces. We do all kinds of things that our evolution doesn't drive us to do. Evolution had no say in why we went to the moon or why we invent cars or whatever it might be. So what relevance is there really? Haven't we outgrown it?
Well, I agree that in lots of ways, it's not all down to banal evolutionary pressures and that kind of thing. So there are cultural pressures that come in and shape our behavior as well. And I think really just the question is it just down to those cultural factors? And in terms of whether we've outgrown it, I think we might have, but we still might have the imprint from these past selection pressures. So like if some folks decide, okay, I don't want to have any kids in my life. I'm happy not having kids, so I'm going to be child-free. In a certain sense, you could say that, in that sense, they've outgrown the need for genitals and for reproductive functions, but they still have them because in our evolutionary history, those things evolved. And we don't have any problem with that when it comes to physical things like genitals and wombs and the like. But I just think that the same is true of certain psychological tendencies as well, is that even if we have in a certain sense outgrown them, we do still have a push from our genes that were pieced together in the human genome from earlier selection pressures.
If our genes are driving us to propagate them into the next species, why don't more men go to sperm banks and try to spread their seed as far as they can?
Yeah, well, if we'd evolved to consciously and deliberately try to have as many offspring as we possibly could, then we probably would do that, right? That would be a good way to do it. But we haven't evolved to think, okay, I want as many of my genes as possible to go into future generations. And in my current environment, completely evolutionarily unprecedented environment, that'd be the best way to do it. Instead, we've just got a bunch of motivations and desires and drives that typically, at least in throughout most of our evolutionary history, led us to act in ways as if that's what we were thinking when we weren't actually thinking about that at all. Any more than any other animal is thinking about, oh, I need to pass my genes on, so I'm going to have sex with this individual here. Other animals aren't thinking about that. We didn't evolve to think about that either. We just have certain desires that push around our behavior, even today, even in a very different world.
Why do you think we have non-reproductive fetishes? Why do you think homosexuality exists? Why do you think people get off on feet or chairs or whatever? Like, what's that all about?
No idea. I don't think that any of those things can easily be traced to evolution, though. I really don't have a clue with things like foot fetishes, where they might come in. So I don't think they're adaptations or anything like that. I think that I guess my best guess would be that we have quite a flexible sexual nature, and we do have a capacity to learn. Like, not everything's pre-programmed. We do have a capacity to learn to find certain things attractive, and maybe with feet fetishes, that capacity just happened to focus on something that is sort of not obviously reproductively relevant. And with homosexuality,
and I suppose it may be the case that, well, just to sort of speculate from a layperson's perspective, it may be the case that if you were to turn down the dial of the libido to such an extent that you erased aberrations like foot fetishes, then you would also lower the propensity to spread your seed in useful reproductive ways as well. Maybe fetishes and kinks just come along for the ride if you hit the right setting of having a high enough libido to be optimal about spreading your genes.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that's quite possibly the case. It's just a kind of byproduct of having a high sex drive. And
You were going to say homosexuality. Is there a similar explanation for that?
It's a similar kind of one. I think, though, similar in the sense, like, I don't think that homosexuality is an adaptation. I think so it has been argued. There was one argument, for instance, that it is an adaptation shaped by what's called kin selection. And the idea there is that
kin selection.
Yeah,
I'm just correcting your terrible New Zealand accent. But yes, kin. Yeah. Explain what kin selection is.
So usual natural selection is when a trait is selected because it boosts the survival or the number of offspring of the individual with that trait. Kin selection is when a trait is selected because it boosts the survival and the number of offspring of genetic relatives of the trait. So a tendency to care for one's offspring, to care for siblings, nieces and nephews, and that kind of thing. And the argument that E.O. Wilson and several other people made was that maybe homosexuality is a product of kin selection, and that some individuals boost their what's called their inclusive fitness, so their overall fitness, that means like the extent to which their genes go forward to the future generations, by instead of having offspring of their own, they instead care for the offspring of siblings. So in other words, nieces and nephews. And it makes sense. It's got a logic to it. It doesn't seem that's the case, though. It doesn't seem that that gay people do disproportionately look after nieces and nephews compared to non-gay people. So
And the amount that they would have to do it would be enormous. I mean, Dawkins has made the point that, you'd have to be twice, you know, the nieces and nephews would have to be more than twice as likely to survive than those who didn't have gay uncles.
Exactly.
Because only half of the genes from the gay uncle are in the child. So if we rule out that as not a very plausible explanation, what are we left with?
We are left with that it's probably a non-adaptive byproduct of some sort. So it's partly down to genes. So same-sex sexual orientation is partly heritable. And then the question is, how do those genes stay in the gene pool?
And just explain heritable there, because a lot of people will hear that and go, well, hang on, does that mean that gay people are more likely to have gay kids? But that's not what heritable means.
No, it just means
– doesn't mean inherited. It doesn't mean that you have the same I'm forgetting my genetic terminology, but the same presentation of
phenotype.
The same phenotype, thank you very much, the same phenotype as the parent.
No, indeed. But it does mean that it's partially determined by genes. So a trait is heritable to the extent that individual differences and whatever trait it is are partly due to individual differences in the genes that people have. So there are some genes that do somewhat increase the likelihood of somebody having same-sex sexual orientation.
Why would those genes get weeded out of the population?
Yeah. That's the mystery, right? Why wouldn't they? I don't think it's known for certain, but there are a bunch of interesting ideas about why it is. One of which is, so if you find those genes in an individual who doesn't happen to actually develop a same-sex sexual orientation, there's some speculation that those individuals are actually have higher fertility and more offspring with those genes to a sufficient degree that it is a counterbalance to the fact that individuals who do develop a same-sex sexual orientation are likely to have fewer offspring. But I'm not sure we really know. And also, it's not completely down to genes. So there's a non-genetic component as well. And one idea about what might be contributing there, have you heard of it? It's called the birth order effect.
Yeah, explain it.
So the idea is that the original idea anyway, it's got a bit messy actually over the years, but the original idea applies to men specifically, as the more older brothers an individual has, the greater their chance of being gay.
And this is not a cultural effect because it even withstands children who are adopted, right?
Yep.
So it has. So if the fourth son is adopted at birth, they still show the higher likelihood of being gay, even if they're the eldest in the new foster family, which implies that there's something in utero that's going on.
Yeah, exactly. So it seems to be it's a biological effect, but a non-genetic biological effect. And I think that even though the effect's been demonstrated quite plausibly, I think we're not completely sure what creates the effect. But the main idea is that it's an immune system response and that the mother's immune system over subsequent pregnancies with males specifically, the immune system starts to react to the male fetuses. Somebody put it once like developing an allergy to maleness. And somehow that affects the masculinization of the brain, not in general, but it's specifically related to sexual orientation. And yeah.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the psychological differences that there might be between men and women then as well. You know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about getting more women into STEM, that we all know stories like the James Damore, the Google engineer who was fired after having been invited to contribute to the question of how to get women more involved in STEM, wrote an essay that proposed that maybe females are less interested in such things, and was fired for articulating that point of view. There are various studies whose credibility I don't know, where you get 1,000 men in a room and 1,000 women in another room, and you say to each of them, do you want to spend your day taking apart a machine and putting the widgets back together, or coaching a family that's having problems through their emotional issues? And more women tend to go for the latter and more men tend to go for the former. There are those who'll say that that's because we live in a culture that encourages people to think that way. But what would there be an evolutionary explanation for those sorts of differences?
Possibly an evolution could impinge on those things. I think so this is like a real minefield of an area. So I think the first thing to say going into this area is that like it's not necessarily the case, depending on how you define STEM, it's not necessarily the case that there are more men than women in STEM. If you include, for instance, the health sciences, it's actually reasonably even, especially among younger generation. It's pretty even overall. So it's not so much that just...
And there are vastly more women young women in going into health science than
exactly.
males.
Yeah, exactly. So rather than the difference to be explained being men do STEM and women don't, it's more men than women go into certain STEM fields, more women than men go into others.
And it is consistent with the preconception that the fields of STEM that men would be more interested in would be the engineering widget side, and that women would be more interested in the health science side, which has more to do with human beings. Rather than widgets.
So
the cliche still stands.
The cliche does still stand. And then the usual explanations for those differences, the ones that are emphasized the most, are discrimination and socialization. And I think discrimination and socialization are certainly part of the story. But I do think, on top of that, though, there is what you say as well. There do seem to be, for whatever reason, there do seem to be average sex differences in interest in objects, widgets, gadgets, and things. So more men than women are interested in that cluster of stuff. And then interest in people and working with people and helping people. Both sexes are pretty interested in that, but on average, women seem to be more interested. And I think it's quite plausible that that is part of the story in determining the fact that more men go in one direction, more women go in other directions. And in fact, it's not just plausible. I think it would be surprising, given that there are those differences, if that weren't part of the explanation for the choices that people make.
Right, but how does 100,000 years on the savannah influence that?
I'm not too sure. So I think there's pretty good evidence that, first of all, that these differences do exist. I think the research is pretty strong on that count. There's also pretty good evidence that it's not 100% down to learning. I think there does seem to be an innate push as well. But unlike sex differences in aggression and sexuality, where we have precedents for that in other species, and we have really, really strong theories in evolutionary biology that explain those differences, I think there's a bit of a question mark over why it might be that the people versus things sex difference evolved. Some ideas have been put forward, but I don't think that they're I don't find any click into place in the same way that the evolutionary explanation for sexuality and aggression does click into place.
What are some of the explanations proposed?
The explanation, well, I guess the more plausible one is the explanation for women's greater interest in people. And people have tied that to two main things. One is motherhood. So the fact that female mammals in general are more involved with offspring could create a selection pressure for a stronger interest in and ability to read people and greater social skills, basically, for in that role with the mother and child bond. And also another argument is that throughout most of the course of our evolutionary history, women were more likely than men to leave the natal group and to set up shop with the husband's natal group. So the husband would stay with his family and the woman would move to his kin group more often than the reverse. Not a massive difference. I think it's like 2/3 of the time it was that way, perhaps, versus 1/3 of the time the other way around, or something different. But enough that the argument goes there was a stronger selection pressure on women to have the social acumen to be able to get on with unrelated other women in particular, but unrelated individuals in general.
Right.
And then the object, the argument for the sex difference in objects relates to tool use, specifically in the context of hunting and warfare. So hunting mainly done by men. Some of it was done by women, but mainly by men. So the tools used for hunting were built more by men than by women and used more by them. And likewise, weapons for warfare as well. And that all seems to me, okay, maybe could be true, but I don't know. Wouldn't want to bet my life savings on those being the true explanations.
And you also write about jealousy and sexual jealousy and possessiveness between people. There's a long-running anthropological argument about whether this is a cultural artifact of modern Western male-dominated societies. Margaret Mead famously went to the Pacific and found that, you know, there were these societies that were free from sexual jealousy, supposedly. She found this and was later brought into question. To what extent are we hardwired to be jealous?
Well, I think to some extent we are. I do think that it's not just an invention of culture. And I think actually it might have been one of your countrymen, Derek Freeman, I think was one of the people who...
That's true, yes.
Yeah, claimed to...
In fact, David Williamson wrote a play about that controversy.
Oh, really?
Our greatest playwright. Yeah, it was called Heretic.
I did not know that. Interesting. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
So that claims along the lines of what Margaret Mead said, that there are some idyllic cultures where people are immune from jealousy and everyone just shares alike and not too fussed if a person that they're involved with gets involved with somebody else. That's been claimed. Margaret Mead claimed that. Various other people have claimed that. Most of the time, however, when you look more closely at the claims, that seems not to be the case. So if you look, for instance, at rates of like the causes of domestic abuse and the causes of spousal homicide and that kind of ugly stuff, you do find that even in those societies where supposedly, according to Westerners, idyllic paradises with no sexual jealousy, sexual jealousy is the major cause of domestic abuse and spousal homicide in those cultures.
And what's the evolutionary reason for that?
The evolutionary reason, so for both sexes, there's some overlap for both sexes. So I mentioned that we evolved to form pair bonds, and those are primarily like a context for looking after kids. The fact that we evolved to form pair bonds means that pair bonds were useful for males and females. We evolved to fall in love with each other because it was useful for both of us. And jealousy, I guess, so like love is like the carrot that entices people into relationships. Jealousy is like the stick where you protect a pair bond from, you know, the good looking next door neighbor or whatever else, some potential threats to the pair bond, threats to, in the sense of like your mate being poached away from you. So I think that's a reason for both sexes to have jealousy, to preserve the pair bond. There's also a reason that's unique to males only. And that's the fact that in species like mammals, you have internal fertilization. And where you have internal fertilization, there's a major sexual asymmetry and the likelihood that you're going to end up looking after your own offspring. So like the way I put it in the book, and I borrow this is the way David Buss likes to put it. David Buss, the evolutionary psychologist, he points out that there's never been a woman in the history of the world who's given birth and then thought, wait a minute, how do I know that this is my kid and not some other woman's kid? Like, that's never happened. For men, on the other hand, if a man's partner gives birth to a kid, it's probably his kid. Odds are that it is, but there's always some possibility that it might not be. And if it's not, if it happens to be the good-looking next-door neighbor's kid, then he's going to be investing his time and energy into putting forward the genes of someone other than himself. And so that's
so males who had a problem with their female partners possibly cheating on them tended to do better.
Exactly.
Than ones who thought who were cool with it.
Exactly. Than ones who just
in terms of, from thought, a gene side point of view, they tend exactly to pass their genes on more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So they pass their genes on more than a guy who thinks, well, I'm an enlightened guy, and that's just fine with me. If I don't mind if my partner sleeps with other people.
So how does it feel to you to be witnessing, I guess, over the past 10 years, the ructions in what it means to be male and the sort of, I guess, eruptions of toxic masculinity in forms like Andrew Tate and like visions of, you know, hyper sexist, hyper misogynistic masculinity. Do you look at that through your lens as an evolutionary biologist and go, like, what do you make of that?
Yeah. So a lot of that stuff it's easy enough to sort of trace it to evolved tendencies. But of course, the fact that something has evolved doesn't mean that it's good. And I think one of the great accomplishments of civilization has been to tame the bad side of human nature to a great extent, and especially male nature and aspects of things that are more common in males than females, like aggression. I think we have really succeeded in taming those to a great extent, as you know, Steven Pinker has documented that. And I think that's the overall trend. And then the kind of stuff you're talking about is, I guess, a bit of a retroactive tendency within that overall trend of managing to push down these levels. And so, yeah, I think that it's not good. It's bad stuff, even if it could be traced to human nature or is maybe sort of emphasizing a side of human nature. Because human nature is not just necessarily exactly going to be at one, any trait like aggression is not going to be at one particular volume. Culture can turn up the volume on it or turn down. And overall, we've been turning it down. But the Andrew Tates of the world, I think, can turn up some of the ugly sides of the ugly potentialities in human nature.
I mean, as someone who's a journalist and not a scientist and who is interested in the kind of sociology of all this, I am interested in what provokes perverse backlashes. And when you said, you know, this idea that I'm an enlightened guy, I'm free from sexual jealousy, I am cool with my female partners doing whatever it is that they want to do. You know, I'm on board the train of whatever it is that is going to get me the I guess, the highest status virtue signaling to my female colleagues, which I think there's a whole other thing going on of like the wolf in sheep's clothing component of particularly sensitive New Age guys who loudly profess how free they are from the impulses that you're talking about, that may have provoked this backlash of people saying, well, hang on a second, that's not right or natural, or that's not me, or these guys are full of shit, or whatever it might be. Maybe that creates a space for it.
Yeah, it could well. I think that's entirely plausible. And maybe some of the negativity that is directed toward males, I think quite plausibly, you know, some young guys might just think, well, screw you to the world, and then be open to, you know, to negative influences of those kinds. I think that probably plausibly contributes as well.
What do we know about the instinct to tribalism?
Well, I think that is also something that sadly is part of human nature. And like one line of evidence for that is that you find it in many species. Many species that live in groups seem to have kind of built-in in-group, out-group biases. And even there's this really interesting paper, one of my favorite papers actually, that points out that even that the neurophysiology underpinning in-group, out-group biases are quite common to vertebrates in general. So it seems to be quite a deep-seated tendency.
Not just mammals.
Not just mammals, yeah. Yeah,
like vertebrates. Fish have in-groups?
I'm not sure about fish.
Lizards?
I think it's group living lizards, group living birds as well, I think, like colonial birds. Yeah. Mm. So I think it's really deep seated.
Does that come back to a concept of kin selection or something? Like what's the evolutionary reason?
I think it's beyond that. I think it's because our tribe is broader than just the kin group. I think it also embraces unrelated individuals. So I think
we're all related in a tribe, aren't we?
But not just closely related. But individuals who are distantly enough related that they are non-related. They're non-relatives.
Right, that there wouldn't be a genetic imperative for them to help each other.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think it's more a cooperative kind of thing. Like they're all in this together and they cooperate with each other. Which is nice within the group, and group cooperation is nice, but it also often, the sort of dark flip side of that is negativity toward other groups and a propensity toward aggression for other groups. And I think that's another thing, though, that we have managed to tame with culture to quite some degree. Not completely, of course, and keep having flare-ups of in-group, out-group biases and nationalism, et cetera. But I do just think that the idea that we think other groups matter as much as our own group, and I happen to be born in this nation, but other nations are not inferior. All those kind of ideas, I think, don't come naturally to us, but culture has kind of pushed us in that direction. Mm.
But what does come naturally to us is, I can't remember exactly how you articulate the distinction, but a tendency to be generous and inclusive towards our own kind, and then to sharply demarcate the boundary between us and them and be vicious and hostile towards the other. How does that dynamic work?
I think that's right. And I think, I guess it's not automatic hatred. I think probably it's wariness. But neighboring tribes, I think, were often quite hostile to one another throughout the course of our evolution. And people had to be very, very careful of them. And so I think just we have an evolved wariness and just an evolved tendency to just very, very easily divide the world into us and them and decide that us is great and superior and them, you know, they're bad and inferior and they're out to get us. And so we need to defend ourselves. And meanwhile, they have the same propensity. They're thinking the same thing, that they're great and that the other side is the bad side and that they're plotting against them and that they need to protect themselves from that.
And are you thinking, that tendency worked in our evolutionary history because of scarce resources, and there wasn't, because you can imagine a universe of infinite resources in which that is a dysfunctional characteristic, and you'd be better off just being nice to everybody.
Yep. I think it probably did I guess scarce resources, but I guess just the fact that there are like tribes even today will sometimes invade other tribes to take resources, but actually also to take females. So groups of males will sometimes take hostage females. A lot of it apparently is about that. And so in a world where resources are scarce and other groups are potentially dangerous, I think it was probably adaptive on average, even if not in every case. Like I do take your point that having that mindset would sometimes provoke conflicts that wouldn't necessarily have happened otherwise and could lead individuals to lose their lives, et cetera. But I guess the thing is that it must have been useful enough on average to have persisted.
Yes, and it's very easy to stoke, as we can see today.
Exactly.
Not just in the culture wars in our own navel-gazing countries, but also writ large in Russia and Ukraine and so many other places.
Exactly, yeah. And I was going to ask, actually, I was wondering, so what sort of stuff do you have on your mind when you're asking about those? Is it things like...
Yeah, I was thinking about Russia and Ukraine, but I was also thinking on a more micro level at the deterioration of a sense of universalism in Western societies, I think, both the rise of the far right and also the descent of the left into a much more identitarian outlook and a much less universalist vision of common humanity for everybody, but more about like this is my tribe. This is a tribe that's been historically persecuted.
Yeah.
Now it's our time to get some kind of comeuppance. It's very much more a finite pie that's being divided at the moment culturally. I think rather than the universalism of the left in the 20th century.
I think you're right, and I think that it's that overall it's a real shame because I think that that universalism was a real accomplishment of culture and going against some of the worst angels of our nature. And it was obviously a fragile...
Well, two white males would say that, wouldn't we?
Exactly. So I suppose that we should add that some of the issues that are being raised are perfectly legitimate. And so I guess the question is, like, how can we reconcile that universalism with giving due consideration to some of the specific problems that have faced...
And asking whether or not the current trends actually do achieve their stated goals. I mean, I always just try to keep in my mind Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Nelson Mandela and try to think of where they were shooting. And, I think, not to big note myself, I think my worldview is closer to where they were aiming for than the worldview of many of the people who claim to be on the side of social justice today.
I agree, and me too. I agree. Those three are great, great individuals, and I much prefer their way of approaching it.
One fascinating way that you start the book is by writing as if you were an alien coming down to planet Earth and observing Homo sapiens. Where did you get that conceit from, and can you just summarize for us the gist?
Yeah. Where I got it from, I can't remember. I have seen it around the place here and there. People have done it in books, I guess, a little bit of it here and there. So I just had in mind in my old notes somewhere, maybe this would be a fun way to start a book. So the basic idea is that an alien comes down to the planet. The alien is from Beetlejuice 3, and it's an alien from a very different species than our own. It doesn't have males and females. It doesn't fall in love. It doesn't get jealous. It doesn't have children, so it doesn't have special relationships with its children. It doesn't listen to music. Doesn't have art, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know what it does have, but all that stuff it doesn't have. And then it comes to our planet, encounters this strange being, these human beings, and we're just a complete mystery to it. So for some reason, we do have males and females, and most people are either of one type or the other. The males and females differ from each other on average. They don't differ as much, though, as a lot of the other animals that the alien spots, like gorillas and orangutans and elephant seals. We fall in love with each other. We get jealous when the person that we're in love with gets involved with someone else. That's generally the case. We hypnotize ourselves with rhythmical pitches of different durations, entertain ourselves with moving flickering lights on two-dimensional screens, et cetera, et cetera. And the alien's just mystified. And it's basically just, it's two things. It's one I just find it quite amusing to play with that thought experiment. And the other is just a way to introduce the questions that I try to tackle in the book. Some of which, so the ones we've been talking about so far have involved evolutionary theory applied to biology. I'm not sure how much we've mentioned this already. I think maybe we haven't, but I also, toward the end of the book, I take evolutionary principles and try to apply them to culture instead. And between the two,
yeah, that was the next chapter of this conversation. Okay. So let's talk about culture. Yeah, sure. Because I mean, one of the points that you make in that initial passage is about how weird it is that we spend so much of our lives looking at stories of other made-up stories that we know are made up of other people, of other fictitious characters doing things and acting out our struggles. And we listen to music and we talk. We spend an enormous amount of time just opening this hole in our face and barking noises at each other. Yep. And this is, we are alone amongst the animal kingdom in spending our time this way. Why?
Well, it's weird, isn't it? I think so. Some people argue that things like music and art and storytelling and that kind of thing are adaptations. And I kind of think my own view is that they're not. I think they're cultural inventions. I think the adaptation, I think we did evolve our abstract intelligence that human beings have. We have more of it than any other species. So our big brains, the reason that we have allomaternal care and paternal care. There's big brains and intelligence, and evolving this intelligence and also our cultural capacity, so our capacity to learn from each other, pass on culture down the generations, kind of became an open system. And I think in doing that, we managed to just invent novel, unique, and evolutionarily non-adaptive, just not adaptive ways to amuse ourselves, ways to stimulate our brains in ways that we just happen to find enjoyable. So I think that's what music is for the most part. It's just a trick we've invented to amuse ourselves. I think stories, they push evolved buttons. So we are interested in other people. We pay a lot of attention to this person is attracted to that person, and those two, they're in love, and this person's cheating on that person, and these two hate each other and they're going to fight, that kind of thing. We've evolved an interest in that kind of thing in real life, but stories can piggyback on that, and stories can be interesting, and they can be stimulating because we have that evolved interest, and we found a way with our stories to amuse ourselves, basically.
In addition to amusing ourselves, we also love understanding things, and only fairly recently, really, have we gotten good at that in a rigorous way. Since the Enlightenment, have we figured out systems of understanding the world that were more than just scattershot, but led us towards incredible breakthroughs. I mentioned landing on the moon. It's no small feat a couple of hundred years to go from not really understanding that the planet is even a planet to being able to land on the moon. So something went right with the scientific revolution. What's the basis of that? I mean, that seems like we've evolved into becoming gods.
I know. It's incredible, right? It's absolutely unbelievable that we got to the moon, let alone all the other stuff we're doing. AI, I didn't even mention AI in the book because it's only a few years ago that I wrote the book, but already that's just jumped ahead massively. Yeah, and I think so. We do seem to have we have an interest in how things work and that kind of thing. And I think that probably throughout most of our evolutionary history, that was useful just within the context of everyday life and figuring out how to make a trap that works and how to process food in a way that gets rid of poison and makes it easier to eat and digest. Things like that, I think we did get right. But we just evolved this open-ended interest that we basically got wrong most of the time outside the scope of everyday life. Like you say, until recently, when suddenly we just sort of figured out the scientific method and how to get it right, even in areas outside everyday life. And then it just completely came off the leash and just completely went well beyond what our observing alien would expect from an intelligent but not, you can imagine, a vastly more intelligent species. The alien is a vastly more intelligent species. Like we're not cognitively impressive at all to this alien, and yet somehow we've gone to the moon and we've done all these other things. And that's because...
And how does the evolutionary biologist explain that drive? How does the evolutionary biologist explain Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos being infatuated with going to space? Is this that we evolved to like tools?
I suppose it could be. I think probably I would probably explain it in more general terms of just an evolved tendency to just want to figure out how things work in everyday life, including tools, but just more than that. And I think what the evolutionary biologist would do would say, so that's the starting point. That's what gave us our intelligence, our ability to understand cause and effect relationships, our interest in trying to figure out stuff. But then the evolutionary biologist, I think, would hand over the task to cultural evolutionary theorists to explain how we got so far beyond that and into areas that are not immediately related to evolutionary considerations. I think the cultural evolutionist would say that that what's happened is that because we evolved this intelligence and this cultural capacity, we basically evolved the capacity to stockpile knowledge and then to add to this common pool of knowledge over time, slowly tinkering with it and slowly improving it over time in such a way that it just slowly adds up and adds up and adds up until we suddenly had knowledge that no single individual could possibly have pieced together by himself or herself. And that, you know, results in us having ideas in our heads that are many, many times more, they're vastly smarter than we are as individuals.
And why do we need to reach for the heights of a symphony or an incredible piece of literature, you know, just to shift back from science to pure culture, again, with a capital C? What's opera all about?
I guess I said two things in response to that. So like a biological thing, an evolutionary biological thing, and just a cultural thing. One thing is because we've developed these ways of stimulating ourselves, it becomes almost like an independent motivation, somewhat disconnected from evolutionary impulses, like opera or rock music or whatever people happen to like, is just appealing in itself. And so people are motivated to do it just because it is stimulating. It stimulates our brains in ways that weren't evolutionarily sort of sketched out for us, but are still pleasurable. But I do think on top of that, a more basic impulse, we do have an impulse, most people, to impress each other. And the specifics of how we do that vary from culture to culture, and it depends on what's available in the culture. In some cultures, it might be opera, and others, it might be other stuff. But I think we do have that impulse. And maybe to get back to sex differences, maybe on average, stronger impulse to show off among men than among women.
Mm. And there may also be an in-group, out-group thing there as well, right? True. Like I was into this band before you heard of them, or you know, I'm into Guns N' Roses. We're all here together. We love Guns N' Roses. Yep. We're all chanting along to Guns N' Roses. That's very tribal.
It was,
that's
yeah, true.
Like sport.
Yeah, true. And like the punks hate all the non-punks and the heavy metalers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I also wonder when I was reading your book and thinking about culture, whether there's an analogy a little bit to what I was saying about sexuality, where you need the dial turned up high enough that you get these artifacts that are unrelated to the original core purpose of the sex drive. And similarly, maybe our intelligence, we've maximized our sheer brain power, and that has weird little sparks that branch off the utility of our intellect and into these other curious realms like Proust and whatever else it might be that they're not, there's no direct evolutionary reason for them, but they're a byproduct of having really big brains that are useful for other things.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's quite a byproduct, right? Human culture.
Yeah.
It's just a byproduct. It's incredible. I wonder if, you know, so there are other species with some degree of culture, like chimpanzees. They have little bits and pieces of culture. They fish for termites and various other things, crack open nuts. And I wonder if they have a little bit of that, a little bit of overflow from their cultural capacity. In fact, I think they probably do, right? Actually, I can think of an example with orangutans. Apparently, there are some orangutans where they, as they're nesting down to go to sleep, they blow raspberries at each other, just in one group, and they don't all do that. But just some do, and that's probably an example of that.
The highest form of culture for me, the fart joke, is a goodie, oldie but a goodie, a trans-species humor.
All these commonalities between species, yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned AI.
Yeah.
Some people think that, you know, the next phase of human evolution or of the evolution of life will be us giving birth to sufficiently complicated systems that it feels like something to be them.
Yeah.
And that they could develop some kind of culture, some kind of instinct, some kind of sense of life beyond ourselves. What do you make of that?
I think a year ago, I would have been a lot more skeptical about all that kind of stuff than I am today. I've just been stunned by what GPT and the like has done in that space of time. And like so in terms of consciousness, right? So that's one thing you're talking about is like, could machines have consciousness? Could there be something that it's like to be a computer or an AI? And I think I've always thought that like in principle, there's no reason why not. So we're basically biological machines and we're conscious. So there's no imprint. Like, so I don't believe we have souls or anything that make us conscious. I just think that we are matter, and matter organized in certain ways can be conscious. We're examples of that. I can't see any particular in principle reason to think that matter in the form of computers couldn't be conscious. I can't see why that would be the case. So in principle, I think it could happen. You could have conscious computers. Yeah. Could they evolve their own culture? I don't see why not. What do you think? What are your thoughts on that? Because it's a very, very tricky question. I don't want to be too confident about it.
I honestly haven't thought about the culture question until this very instant. But it depends on how you define culture. But if you define culture in the broadest possible sense, then any intelligent being is capable of culture.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's sort of a consequence of curiosity. And if a machine is truly aware, if a machine feels conscious, is sentient, then it will have curiosity and that will lead to ideas about things, and ideas will lead to, yeah, to putting those ideas together, which is a form of writing, and that is a form of literature, and that will build a culture.
Yeah. And I wonder, so I guess it'd be culture if you had multiple AIs creating their own
right.
stuff and then sharing it with each other. And
yes,
then some
right.
kind of selection process that some of that is passed on to other AIs. And so you'd have a cultural evolution between different AIs. I guess that would be most analogous to human culture.
That's right, yes. And some of them would have to be stickier than others or, you know.
Yep.
So the AIs would have to be exerting some kind of selection pressure on the various memes to make some succeed and others not.
Yeah. Scary thought.
Scary thought.
Interesting.
Crazy.
Thought, but yeah.
Let's leave it dangling there, Steve. Thank you. Thank you for chatting with me. It's it's great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks,
is there Rich. Anything that is there anything that we haven't touched that is such a juicy piece of fruit that you want to throw it in?
I don't think so. I think that was actually quite a nice place to end it on with our random speculation.
Don't ruin it. Excellent. Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
But that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.